it was a bipartisan vote.
Why?
You know, to ban TikTok.
Why?
Because it's owned by a Chinese company. And
well, then we need to make another app that you can just do the same thing. I like posting these videos. I like it.
I don't know.
I'm getting addicted.
I got rid of it. I don't even have it on my phone.
But see, I post them, you know, for fun in case someone's following me.
Right.
I'm not like looking for stuff on there. I might find jokes. I might find certain like golf tips.
Right.
I like it. There isn't another app that gets it to me like that.
I just don't think that you and I are the actual target audience for TikTok.
We aren't. And that's what our show's about today. We aren't the target audience.
Anymore. No. We're not the TikTok generation.
I'm trying to be.
Oh, hey, Bill. Welcome to the Dana Buckler Show.
Yeah. Hey.
You know what? I just realized I forgot to do the introduction. So we're back. This is going to be When Movies Were Movies, Volume 2.
This is the first time I've made a Volume 2.
Yes, I'm telling you. We did good. We did good on that last one. Got a little bit of feedback. I want to fire off a couple emails that we got here. So let me just see here real quick.
Hello, everybody out there. Hey, it's Bill. It's good to be back. Can't wait to hear this.
This email I got from Jim Salber, who said, True Grit was the Jeff Bridges Coen Brothers Western you were thinking of. Because last time I was like, what was that one that the Coen Brothers did? I couldn't remember it. He goes, I would like your thoughts on them making another Lethal Weapon movie and the remaking of The Naked Gun with Liam Neeson. Thank you. Love the show. Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate the kind words about the show. They're making, as far as I know, and I don't have any notes in front of me here, so let me just say this.
I have notes. Dana doesn't.
From what I understand,
this guy's amazing.
And this could date horribly bad, like when people listen to this 6 months from now. But from what I understand, a fifth Lethal Weapon movie is in development with Mel Gibson going to direct it.
Oh.
You know, because the first four Lethal Weapon movies were directed all by Richard Donner, who sadly passed a couple years ago. He was like 91 or something. Like, he was still going to do the fifth one, you know. Look, I'll just say it. Mel Gibson has a troubled past, if you will. You know,
he's, come on.
You
know, I mean,
but
sure.
But if you separate the art from the artist, I think he's a very good director. I mean, he directed Braveheart.
Yeah,
he directed The Passion of the Christ. He directed Hacksaw Ridge. You know, he's done some movies.
And,
you know,
and as an actor, hello.
Yeah, no, yeah, he's
awesome.
Yeah.
Give me back my son. What's that from? You remember that?
Ransom. Yeah. Ransom was one of the top 10 movies of 1996.
I used to listen to this sports radio like talk show, and they would just hit that button like all day long.
Just randomly.
Would, like six in a row. Give me back my son.
As far as the remake of The Naked... Oh, okay. Let me just answer Jim's question.
Thank you, Jim, for the email, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. I am cautiously... Well, I wouldn't even say cautiously. I'm interested to see what a Mel Gibson-directed Lethal Weapon movie would be because, you know, the Lethal Weapon movies are absolutely defined as action comedies.
Yeah, I was going to say fun. Action fun. Yeah.
So
along for the ride.
You know, the thing is, Mel Gibson, I don't know when the last time is that you saw Apocalypto, but not funny.
No.
Not a lot of comedy in that movie.
I would say he's more serious.
Yeah, he's an excellent... He can shoot action sequences and violence like no one's business.
That's why you need a good director.
Watch Braveheart.
Get him to be funny because he is funny. He's just
I just how is he with comedy Tommy?
Don't know.
You know, that's that. You know what? It remains
Maybe
to
we
be
will
seen.
See.
But at the same time, it's a remake.
Exactly.
I mean, not a remake. At the same time, it's a sequel. You know.
All the above.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, you know, we'll
It'd
see.
Be fun. It could
we'll
be
see.
Fun.
I if you told me that Mel Gibson was going to make an original movie with an original story, and Danny Glover. And Joe Pesci and Rene Russo, all the people from the Lethal Weapon movies were in it, I'd be like, I'd probably rather see that.
I'm probably going to watch.
So, got another email here. It says, Hi, Dana. Thoroughly enjoyed your When Movies Were Movies podcast. I'm the same age as you, 46 this year, and all of your perspectives and stories resonate with me, i.e. pre-internet era of the 1980s and 90s. Some movies that I consider cinematic masterpieces are The Deer Hunter, Blade Runner, First Blood, The Terminator, Wall Street, Bloodsport, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, Heat, Fight Club, and finally Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy.
That's a good list.
It is a good list. I genuinely hope you have the inspiration and the energy to continue podcasting, Dana, listening to someone the same generation as myself. Regards, Peter from Australia.
Peter, I thank you for sending that.
Yeah.
I hopefully I make Peter's next email. I just want him to just put Bill in there.
Well, I know you did a response to it.
I did. And I wore a shirt for him today. I put on my John Rambo First Blood.
To be fair, Peter, Bill is wearing a t-shirt that has a mugshot of John Rambo from the First Blood movie. So,
Peter, thank you from down under. From down under.
He is looking very American right now with his Black Rifle coffee company hat on as well. And a John Rambo shirt.
And my fake Oakleys.
And your fake Oakleys.
Well, actually, these are blenders. You can cut that out if you want.
So,
love blenders.
But, you know, so obviously we're striking a chord with some people out there. People
I know,
are like,
it's
hey,
good.
listen. You're right. There was a time when movies were movies. So why not talk about a few more?
Yeah,
I got a few more recommendations.
I'll tell you this. So just last night, I watched another one, you know, that I wanted to talk about today. Yeah. And when I was doing some research, I'm looking through, I actually Googled R-rated movies 1980.
Okay? Yeah.
And I did the same thing with, it seemed like every movie.
Yeah.
there were comedies and I'm going, oh my God, these are all R-rated.
Yeah.
Right. Because they were made for us. They were made for adults.
That's right.
They weren't made for, let's try to get, you know, little Timmy and soccer mom and, you know, all the kids from the neighborhood to hopefully go to the movies. This was, let's go out, you know, watch a movie as adults.
I have five movies on my list. Four of them are rated R and one of them is rated PG.
Dana.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. I can't wait.
Yeah, four are rated R.
Not even PG-13.
Not even PG-13.
Okay.
No. But when I tell you what the movie is, I think you're going to be like, oh, yeah. I don't even think it's a movie you think about what it's rated.
Right.
Because it's not got a lot of hardcore violence. It has no sex, no language, but it still keeps you on the edge of your seat.
Mine are all R-rated.
That's good. Well, then let's go ahead and knock out the PG one first on my list. I am talking about the John McTiernan directed. Now, John McTiernan, all right, Predator, Die Hard, and the 1990 film, first one on my list, The Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, love
great,
love it.
Great movie.
Love it.
Talk about it. Now, talking about it just for a moment, this is a big budget Cold War espionage thriller rated PG. Definitely not, you know, billed as a big summer blockbuster, but made a ton of money.
Yes.
And is super entertaining. And not a lot happens in that movie.
It's just like two heavyweights on film, right?
It's Sean Connery, Alec Baldwin, James Earl Jones. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on.
It's just that, to me, I'm just thinking, like, it had to have been the language. It just hadn't have been bad language.
There wasn't
nothing
bad language.
Else would have happened.
No, right? Yeah. I mean, but if it, like, I watched this last week. There's a podcast I listen to called Blank Check, which is one of my top favorite movie podcasts.
And
they're doing a whole series on all John McTiernan films right now.
Okay.
And I listened to their episode about The Hunt for Red October. I'm like, I love that movie. Let me sit down and watch that again. And I was like, I've seen that movie 10 times in like the last 20 minutes. I was just like, I was on the edge of my seat. Yeah. I'm like, this is incredible.
Great finish. Great finish.
So for those who don't know, It's Tom Clancy. It's actually his first published book. First book he ever got published was The Hunt for Red October.
And the character too, right? That's the big...
Jack Ryan.
Yes,
yeah, it's the
Ryan.
Debut of Jack Ryan.
What a franchise that turned out to be.
They originally wanted Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford turned the role down. They ended up going with Alec Baldwin. This was kind of the movie that made him a star. And he, up until that point... was kind of relegated to always a supporting role, but this was his first lead role, and he nailed it. But when it came time to make the sequel, Patriot Games, Harrison Ford was like, I'm in.
His hands up. Hi, please, here. Hi.
Any three of those movies, Hunt for Red October, Patriot Games, and Clear and Present Danger, any three could have made my list of when movies were movies.
Agree.
All three of those represent films that are, again, excellent, successful, and made for adults.
And that also goes back to one of my other points. When word of mouth would travel.
Yeah.
And once the first wave of people went and saw Clear and Present Danger, let's just say.
Yeah.
And there's some big scenes in that. And you see the trailer commercials. Everyone's like, you got to go to the movies to see that. Because you didn't know how long it was going to take to get on Blockbuster or when it would actually get to rental. It could be a long time. That's why you had to go to the movies, because you didn't know how long it would be till you...
Bill, you bring up two very, very good points. Two very good points.
Thank
that,
you.
That we need to...
That's the first time you've ever said that.
Well, listen, we got to...
No, sometimes I get one good point.
Listen, you have two. Let's unpack both of this just for a moment, okay? So I'm going to take the second part first, which is, you're absolutely correct. We had no idea when it left the theater, how long before it would come on home video.
Sometimes like a now, year. For some movies, you're like, you forgot about it.
I'll give you an example.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Terminator 2 Judgment Day comes out July of 1991. All right. I see it maybe the third week it's been out in the theater. One of the great experiences of my life. Do you know when that movie came out on home video?
I mean, the way you're setting it up, probably the next year.
5 months later.
Yeah, exactly.
In December.
That's a lifetime back then.
And I remember I would call the local video store. This is back up in Canada.
Right.
Every week and would be like,
is it in?
Has Terminator 2 come out
is
yet?
It in?
And finally they said, listen, stop calling.
Right.
We'll call you.
And then that first week they get it. It's already checked
they
out.
They had five copies. It was gone.
Can't even get it.
It was gone. So you're right. They didn't know. Now I will say, as the 90s sort of progressed and DVD started to, you know, peek its head in just a little bit, DVDs were cheaper to manufacture, faster to manufacture,
smaller, lighter.
It cost a studio 20 cents to manufacture a DVD. The process of creating VHS rental tapes, that just took a lot longer, cost a lot more money. So the studio could get a film out quicker. You know, towards the late 90s, but in the 80s and early 90s, it would be 6 months to even a year before it would hit home video.
Yep. And you know, at the beginning of the VHS run there, like, you might get one copy, you know.
And videotapes were not cheap. All right.
I remember being like they really were,
they were over $100. They were over $100 a piece.
Right.
Because the studios could charge that, because the only people that were buying them were video rental stores that the studios knew that they were going to make money off of these. So this is a $100 investment. And, you know, if you get this film rented 100 times at $3 a rental, you know, you've tripled your investment, times that by 1,000 movies in your video store. Like, so the numbers all made sense.
Sure.
You know, it wasn't until around 92, 93 that movies started being priced like for the public.
And that was Blockbuster too.
Yeah, you could buy a copy of Jurassic Park for $25.
And that was cool.
Something
you'd never get in your hand, now you have it, you owned it. And it was so cool.
That was like a big thing.
Oh my gosh, yes.
But the other point that you brought up.
Point number two, listeners.
To go to the first point you brought up, was the power of word of mouth. That was a big, big thing.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Well, you couldn't text anyone. Couldn't email them.
No, like you would
talk.
You would. There was something. There was an old
the water saying, cooler.
The water cooler talk. Yeah, the water. It was, you know, people, you know, hovering around the water cooler. So what'd you do this weekend? Oh, I saw the new Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Total Recall. It was incredible. Yeah. Oh, I might take the wife to go see that this weekend.
God, the old days.
You know, you just couldn't. Yeah, the word of mouth was huge. And it would also be a killer if the movie wasn't good.
Or how about this? Or if the one person that didn't like it says it, maybe the movie's great.
But I'll give
but you have no room for research.
I'll give you an example of how serious studios took word of mouth. Okay. There are certain movies that studios knew were not going to be good. But they have to release them. They've already invested millions. We've got to put it out. So they would do something called not screened for critics. So think your Siskel and Ebert, people like that. They would get they would get to go, they would get invited to these screenings, early screenings, and then they would give their review the weekend the movie came out. Well, there were some movies that studios knew that were going to get just savaged by the critics, so they just wouldn't release them. But they would hope that the movie, at least on its opening weekend, would make a lot of money. And I'm going to give you a perfect example.
Okay.
Here's a perfect example of a movie that was not screened for critics that had a strong opening weekend and then word of mouth spread and it fell out of the top 10 the following weekend. All right. And that would be a little movie called Caddyshack 2.
Oh.
They did not screen that movie for critics. All right. But the studio was hoping that the name alone, Caddyshack 2, and they slapped Chevy Chase on the, you know, he's in that movie for 5 minutes. They slapped him on the front cover.
Right.
It made $8 or $9 million its opening weekend, opened up to like number two, something like that. And then word of mouth traveled quickly and it fell out of the top 10, was out of the theaters in 2 weeks.
And it should be out of everyone's minds
so,
forever.
So word of mouth was something that the studios took very, very serious.
Well, they were right on that one.
Yeah.
So I don't even know why.
But if
I
they,
still don't get
but it. If they had screened that movie for critics, they wouldn't have had that opening weekend that they had.
Right, so yeah.
So it was million. A calculated move on
Did
their
they even
part.
Break even?
No.
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 That's a loss.
Now that movie's awful.
Yeah, and hopefully we get to that. I'm hoping to record another episode one day.
Yes.
About Caddyshack.
Yeah, well the original Caddyshack was
it's a great classic. It's not even a cult classic. It's a classic. It's a classic.
But
anyway.
But to circle back real quick to The Hunt for Red October before we move on to the next one is, you know, this is a Cold War thriller about a very well-known Soviet submarine captain, Captain Ramius, played by Sean Connery. Clever move this movie makes is
John McTiernan.
They just tell him, don't even try to do a Russian accent. You're Sean Connery. People will buy it. You know? And so he doesn't even do a Russian accent.
That's what's so hilarious. Yeah. And you do buy it.
And you do buy it because he's Sean Connery. And then the other thing that they do really clever is they start with subtitles. And then he does this really clever thing where, you know, a guy is reading a passage in a book in Russian and the camera moves right up to his face, right up to his lips, and then all of a sudden he starts speaking English and the camera pulls back. And that's the way that John McTiernan says, look, you guys are smart enough as viewers to know he's still speaking Russian, but we're not going to do subtitles for the rest of this movie.
That's cool.
That's really, really clever how he does that. Captain Ramius, he's given command of the latest latest submarine. And from Russia and decides to defect, and it's this cat and mouse game. I don't want to say anything more than that, but it's an awesome movie. So The Hunt for Red October is my first one.
No, that's a great movie, great pick. Just love the finish. What a build up. When you're watching that one at the end, you start sweating. Because you see the sweat on them, right? And you start sweating.
Yeah.
Like you're feeling it.
And a lot of smoking. Great. A lot of smoking in the submarines. And they were doing that in Crimson Tide as well. Yeah. If anyone out there listening served on a submarine in the 80s and 90s, can you verify that you were allowed to smoke inside the submarine?
It doesn't make sense to me.
But did you notice like a lot of smoking?
Yeah.
A lot of smoking. All right. What's one on your list?
Well, I mean, I love this whole genre of just like, because it makes me think about when I was younger and how life used to be. I wouldn't say simpler, but just different, a lot different, because technology really didn't run into the world at that point.
Yeah.
Also, like you said, some of these movies you just can't make anymore.
Yeah.
Right. And I watched one recently from 1982, 48 Hours. Okay.
Lots to say about that.
I want to say a few things, and then I'm going to hand it over to Dana, and then we can go from there. But 1982, Eddie Murphy's pretty much first big movie prior to Beverly Hills Cop.
Yep.
And very similar, kind of a similar character, right? Because he's actually a convict in this. He's not a cop, but he's playing a cop. But some things. Actually won an award for best music. Oh, yeah, music. That's right. So there's some good music in there.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a Golden Globe nominee for new Star of the Year in a motion picture.
Yeah.
So they understood that maybe Eddie Murphy is something other than just the SNL character, right? Because he's really good in this movie.
All right. So to understand, we got to go back 1982. This is now 42 years ago.
This is definitely a movie you cannot make again.
So
curious to hear what
48 Hours stars Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy. All right. Nick Nolte is a cop, through a series of, unfortunate events, Nick Nolte's partner is killed by, some convicts that escape prison. And, Nick Nolte has to enlist the help of another convict, Reggie Hammond, played by Eddie Murphy, and gets him a 48-hour pass to get him out of prison to help him track down, these escaped convicts. Right. Because Murphy was part of that gang. He was part of the gang.
He knew. He was the insider. He knew where they lived. He knew their girlfriends. He knew a lot of good information.
So Eddie Murphy single-handedly saved Saturday Night Live. Because by this point, 81 was when they're making this film. Saturday Night Live, all the original players had left at this point. And Eddie Murphy is literally stealing the show. And he is offered an opportunity to make this movie. He wasn't the original idea. He wasn't the original person they had, Walter Hill had in mind. He originally wanted Gregory Hines to play that role, but that just fell apart for whatever reason. And so he gets Eddie Murphy. Now, Nick Nolte was the bigger star at the time. This can be demonstrated by the fact that Nick Nolte was paid $1 million for his role, and Eddie Murphy was paid $400,000 for his role. 8 years later, when they make the sequel, another 48 hours, Eddie Murphy is paid $10 million to Nick Nolte's $2 million, just to see how much things changed in the 1980s.
Yeah, Eddie is on a rise.
By all reports, with 48 hours, Eddie really struggled in the beginning, in the first couple weeks, because they didn't let him improv. They didn't let him be him.
Yeah, you can see that, because there's a lot of seriousness in the movie, right?
Where things change for Eddie was when they shot that whole country western bar scene. They let Eddie just
be Eddie.
They said, you know what? Just do whatever you want. And he basically improvised that entire scene. Wow. I don't like white people and I don't like rednecks. And I'm not going to say his most famous line. That was the moment where Walter Hill was like, oh, I'm just going to let Eddie be Eddie.
Yeah, because you notice throughout the movie, you hear his signature laugh a couple times at the end of the movie. So you could see how they loosened it up a little bit.
Yeah, it was really
as it went on.
They realized that Eddie Murphy, works best when you just when you unleash him and just let him do whatever he wants to do.
Yeah, and what a rise to Beverly Hills Cop after this.
Yeah, because
I wrote the list down. 48 Hours, Trading Places, Beverly Hills Cop, Golden Child, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Coming to America. Yeah. Keep going.
Yeah.
A run.
Yeah, he dominated.
But he was Eddie being Eddie.
But let's not forget, in between there, he also does Delirious and Raw.
And
makes millions just doing that.
And he deserves all of it because he was the funniest man on the planet for that whole time.
So 48 Hours is, 48 Hours holds up.
It does hold up. I just watched it. The score is 6.9 on IMDb.
Yeah.
Metascore is new to me. I don't know what that. That's like 71. Like a critic score.
Yeah,
Metascore
is kind of it's kind of like Rotten Tomatoes. They just take sort of what's considered a positive review, what's considered a negative review, and just kind of do the average. So
I get it. But better than you. I mean, 6.9 that's pretty high. I would say.
It's 70%. So 7 out of 10 critics liked the movie.
So some of the language, some of the sexual innuendo or the sexual language is...
It doesn't age well?
No, it doesn't age because you probably wouldn't say it the way they said it. But I watched it last night. I was dying. It's funny. Anyway, this is definitely a movie I don't think you can make again.
Yeah,
just the way the world we live in.
All right, so the next one on my list is...
Oh, I want to say one more thing.
Okay, please. Yeah, please.
So the budget on the movie was $12
million. Yeah.
And back then, worldwide gross was $78.8 million. So back then, that's a lot of money.
That's a big hit. Yeah. And, if you do sort of... If you look kind of at the numbers, so if a movie costs $200 million today and it makes a billion, that's considered a huge success. You know, this one cost 12 and it made almost 80. It's the same percentage,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To movie theater tickets didn't cost as much back then. So that's a huge number. No. In fact, after the success of 48 Hours and then Trading Places, Paramount locks him to an exclusive deal. And that is something that they stopped doing in the 60s. They used to do this in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 60s, is studios would have movie stars under contract. So you're only going to make movies for us,
right?
You know? And right. So they gave Eddie Murphy like $20 million. That's a lot of money 40 years ago. You know, and so that's why all of Eddie Murphy's movies in the 80s were all made by Paramount, because they had him under contract. So if any producer wanted to work with Eddie Murphy, they'd have to go through Paramount. When Simpson and Bruckheimer were like, no problem. They're the ones that produced Beverly Hills Cop and Beverly Hills Cop 2. So
it's great.
Yeah, no, it's a great one. Let's see. Another one on my list, 1987's The Untouchables.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Directed by Brian De Palma. Once again, Sean Connery, Kevin Costner, Andy Garcia, Robert De Niro as Al Capone. Do you know what I love about this film, which I watched maybe a month ago, not even realizing that we were going to do this type of little series on the podcast? Just how authentic everything looks. It's a period piece, takes place during Prohibition, 1920s, you know. It looks amazing. It's the story of Elliot Ness, who was an agent for the Treasury Department, who's assigned to Chicago to figure out a way to take down Al Capone, who's played by De Niro. And he puts together this group of this ragtag group of police officers and accountants, if you will.
Yep.
And it's awesome.
I love this movie so much. Huge one for me.
You want to talk about a ridiculous final act, that the scene at the train station with the baby carriages and the slow-mo and everything. Like, it's incredible.
That's top notch.
You know, and Sean Connery steals the show in that movie. There's a scene where, you know, he's trying to...
In the apartment?
The scene where they're doing this, you know, the takedown of the Canadian Mounties.
Oh yeah, in that little house off the river.
And he's got the De Niro's book accountant, and he's trying to get him to talk. He's like, I'm not saying nothing. So he grabs a dead body who the accountant doesn't know is dead, and he says, "Oh, you're gonna just shoot some.
That's great."
I was like, "Oh my god!" But it's got great performances.
Every single actor in a movie kills it.
Untouchables. Great movie. Untouchables. Highly recommend it. Definitely worth your time.
I would recommend that to every single person that's listening. Unbelievable movie.
Awesome. And it's just, like I said, this is 87, so this is pre-CGI. These are sets that are built. These are real car period specific cars and clothing and settings, and it's just
every scene, it flows perfectly. Every scene is just a huge scene. And De Niro's at his best. Costner's at his best.
And it's crazy to think about the level of corruption that was going on. Like,
it's a mafia. I mean, it is a mafia movie.
Yeah. Right. So you have to think about, though, like, I don't want to get into the debate that is, you know, was Prohibition effective? You know, Prohibition lasted from 1920 to 1933.
The mafia thanks them.
And well, it
yeah,
it
they helped, ran the business.
It helped, you know.
But it's business. It's business. Like it or not, they were running business.
For our international listeners that maybe aren't sure, the purchase of alcohol was made illegal in the United States for 13 years. It was known as the Prohibition era. Now, there were a few exceptions to this rule. Number one, if you were in possession of alcohol, like at your home, that was fine. Remember, it was illegal to sell it. It was illegal to buy it.
It's almost like marijuana.
Yeah, but if you possessed it, you know, they didn't really care. Also, it was available for medicinal use. So you could see your doctor and he would prescribe you a pint of whiskey. You know, there were ways around the whole thing. But what bummed out a lot of people was...
Isn't this the dawn of speakeasies too, a little bit?
Well, that's exactly what a speakeasy was, because it decimated the outlaw of the sale of alcohol decimated the nightlife industry in America.
Can you imagine? I mean, from saloons to bars and clubs to we're shutting this down.
Yeah, I mean, it was insane. So that's when speakeasies, and for those who don't know, a speakeasy would have been a private nightclub or bar where there was
Dinner and a movie or
We actually do have a speakeasy at my restaurant, but that's a whole nother story. But it's safe to say that prohibition probably caused more harm than good.
I agree. I see where you're going with that. No doubt.
You know, it helped usher in the rise of the mafia, who made billions from the sale of illegal alcohol.
Shouldn't have been illegal.
Come on. But you know what? That was more than 100 years ago. What's another one on your list?
Just want to say thank you again for that one. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, that's actually one of my buddy's favorite movies.
Yeah, it's a good film.
I've watched that a million times. My shirt, our caller, our listener. Maybe he'll be a caller one day. Our listener.
Jim.
Jim from Down Under?
No. Peter.
Peter from Down Under.
Yeah.
Peter. Love you. Thanks for calling, emailing, whatever. Call in next time. I've got love for First Blood. I'm wearing a shirt. You inspired me. I watched it again. So here's the thing. And this is 1982 as well. The same year as 48 Hours. I love kind of survival movies. I love when either a team gets together and accomplishes something, or in this one, just an individual that's, you know, has to overcome all these hurdles and odds. I just love kind of the survival type thing. And a war of one against one is kind of what I read. So anyway, First Blood's another one on my list.
First Blood, 1982, directed by Ted Kotcheff, is the story behind the movie is almost as good as the movie itself. I'll start by saying that First Blood was based on a novel of the same name written by David Morales from 1972. And he was working as a college professor, and he was listening to stories of returning Vietnam veterans, you know, basically talk about their experiences over in Vietnam and then sort of their experiences coming back to the United States. Because unfortunately, you know, we live in an era now where the men and women in the military are heroes, are considered heroes. And, but that wasn't the case. Protesters were going after the enlisted soldiers who were drafted soldiers who didn't even want to go over there.
Right. They're getting harassed
and giving them a really difficult time.
What a shame. And mental illness wasn't
PTSD.
An open thing with support. Then.
Yeah. Which is just a shameful part.
It is tough.
It's a shameful part of American history. So Morales sort of comes up with an idea for a story about, you know, what happens if one of these individuals just is pushed to the limit and snaps. And he wrote the book First Blood. Now, I have read that book twice, and it is a far different movie. Excuse me. It's a far different book than what the movie ultimately turned out to be. In the book, which the book is set in Kentucky. Okay. And in the book, spoilers for First Blood novel, you know, skip ahead a minute or two if you don't want to hear this, but the book is told simultaneously in two parts. Each chapter is dedicated to either Rambo or Teasel, the sheriff. All right. And it basically tells that both stories at the same time. Teasel's on the hunt for Rambo, and you go to the next chapter, it's what Rambo is doing, and they all sort of come together at the end. And neither character I would consider to be a protagonist in the story. Like, Rambo is not a hero in the novel, and Teasel is not really a good guy either. But I will say this: in the novel, Rambo kills everyone. It's very like the book has him. The movie has him get arrested, taken to, you know, the local jail, the county jail, if you will.
Does he kill anyone in the movie? The one person, right?
He is responsible for the death.
The helicopter.
He's somewhat responsible for the death of one person. But just to put a pin in that just for a moment.
Okay,
So when he escapes the county jail in the novel, he murders a bunch of people and escapes into the foothills of the bluegrass mountains or whatever, completely naked. Okay. and he comes across some moonshiners who he convinces to give him some clothes and a gun. And then the rest of the novel is just this cat and mouse chase where Teasel, you know, and his men are after Rambo, and Rambo just, he just kills everybody.
Okay.
And yeah. enter Colonel Troutman, who's there.
He's in the book.
He's in
that,
the book.
That character. Okay.
He's in the book trying to convince Rambo to give himself up. And then at the end of the book, Rambo mortally wounds Teasel. Teasel wounds Rambo, and Troutman actually kills Rambo with a shotgun. Wow. So it's a vastly different book.
Interesting.
Now, the movie, you know, for Stallone to come on board, he said, well, we have to make Rambo a much more sympathetic, if I'm going to do this, it'd be a much more sympathetic character.
That's Sly.
And Sly is a fantastic writer, you know. Yeah. So they make it a lot different. And you're right, to come back to what you said. Art Gault is the deputy who falls out of the helicopter. He's trying to shoot at Rambo from a hovering helicopter, and at one point unbuckles his seatbelt to get a better shot. And Rambo throws a rock at the helicopter, hits the window, spooks the pilot. The pilot shifts, you know, the controls, and he falls out. That's the only one.
And there's a lot of bullets and fire explosions.
Yeah. So and at the end, the original end of First Blood, the movie, Rambo commits suicide. But they cut that out and reshot the ending, which was very smart, obviously.
Well, it's hard to do a sequel.
It's hard. But it's so funny because when they made a sequel to Rambo, and, you know, Rambo First Blood Part 2 is not a recommend for me. I don't think it's a very good movie.
How about 3?
I don't think 3 is very good either.
I'd have to rewatch them.
They're just...
I was excited when it came out.
Sure.
And we went. That was another one where like, we're going to see this.
When Rambo 3 came out, that was the most expensive movie ever made. Really? Had like a $62 million budget.
And
that was
a huge opening scene.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. And that when he's on the rope and he's hanging there and he gets a bullet. Doesn't he blow a bullet hole through him?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So
a huge scene.
He cauterizes a bullet hole with gunpowder.
There we go.
That goes through his side. You know,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's worth the whole trip for me.
But, you know,
anyway,
when compared, First Blood, I think, the movie is a masterpiece.
It's great. It is. I agree.
And it's so well done, and it's 90 minutes. And apparently, the first version of this movie was like 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
And Rambo had a lot more dialogue, and they just cut it all out.
Okay.
And they just wanted to say as little as possible. And so when he does talk, you know, it's a much more profound. But
that's smart. And this is one where you kind of get on board with him. You're rooting for him.
You right? are rooting.
You know, you're rooting for John Rambo. He's
because
like, he just wanted to walk through town. Like, you poked me.
Now, what's also interesting,
he didn't ask for all that.
To move back to the book just for a moment, you know, if I recall, because it's been a couple of years since I read the book, but if I recall, Rambo keeps coming back to the town.
Oh,
like he keeps coming back to sort of antagonize Teasel.
Poke at something.
Yeah, like Teasel's super cool with him at the beginning and then just lets him order some food, lets him eat, and says, you got to go. But Rambo just keeps coming back to kind of fuck with him a little bit. Yeah. And that's how things sort of really escalate. The movie's a little different.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
The sense
he never
that,
comes back ever. He doesn't
well,
want
to. Well, he just turns around, walks back towards town, and Teasel arrests him right there for vagrancy.
Right.
I mean, First Blood is a masterpiece.
It's awesome. Budget $15 million worldwide, gross $125 million.
Yeah, massive movie. And then spawns a ridiculous franchise.
And
where,
then I also wrote down. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, franchise. I think Rambo 2 and 3.
They're successful.
They're successful. Maybe they're very successful, but don't have the essence of First Blood.
Yeah, on its own, it's its own thing.
It could
almost not even be part of the franchise.
It never needs a sequel. Now, the 2008 Rambo movie where he's in Burma and Myanmar, I think is really good. All right. And then the last Rambo movie, Rambo Last Blood, where he fights the Mexican cartel.
No,
it wasn't for me.
Heard that.
Yeah, it wasn't for me.
Yeah, and then the other kind of notes I wrote down, he has two of the most iconic characters of all time, Rocky and Rambo. And then you said good writer. I mean, it's amazing that he, you know, you think of this guy as this like muscle action figure, but he wrote Staying Alive. Like he's part of the writer-director of Staying Alive, right?
He directed Staying Alive.
With your friend John Travolta.
Yeah.
Amazing guy. My wife actually watches his reality show with his daughters.
I won't bring myself to watch that.
Mel loves it. And I'll tell you what. Great father, great husband. The daughters are amazing. The show's actually, I've watched two episodes with my wife.
All right.
It's not a forced reality show. It's very interesting. He's just a great guy. He's a great guy. What an American treasure. We're lucky to have the guy.
Incredibly
Tulsa
smart
King,
guy.
Expendables. I'm a huge fan of Sly, and I'm proud to have him on my t-shirt.
Absolutely.
So great recommendation from one of our listeners.
Thank you, Peter. So another film that I'm going to talk just very briefly because like Rambo, it did spawn a franchise. I think more highly of a couple of the movies in the franchise than I do for Rambo. And that's Die Hard from 1988.
Another Donner movie?
No, another John McTiernan film. John McTiernan, Hunt for Red October. I don't want to say, I've done full episodes on Die Hard and I've talked about it a lot, but I'm hoping for some of our younger listeners out there that maybe have not seen it. I'm sure they've heard of it.
Please watch it.
It just needs to be clarified again and again how much this movie changed action films forever. You know, because up until that point, we were just getting, you know, your Arnold Schwarzenegger and your Sylvester Stallone big budget action films. Not to say I don't love those movies, but Die Hard's the first movie that introduces us to a protagonist and a hero that's kind of an everyman. Yeah, he's a police officer, but he's a hell of a lot more relatable than these bodybuilding, you know. I'm in the theater watching Commando. I'm like, I'm watching Die Hard. I'm like, well, if I was at that office Christmas party, what would I have done?
Sure.
You know, and he's what we call, the character of John McClane in the original Die Hard is what we call a reluctant hero. Simply put, the only person that he knows at that Christmas party at Nakatomi Plaza in LA is his wife. He wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for his wife. And frankly, if the terrorists take over Nakatomi Plaza and he is able to grab his wife at the beginning and say, let's go.
He'd be gone.
They'd be gone.
Yeah.
Police, you deal with it. Bye. I'm out.
Yes.
I'm out. But because his wife is one of the hostages, he's called to action.
But that says a lot about that character.
Exactly.
That he's saving everyone, putting his life on the line.
Yeah.
Just because that's who he is.
But he wouldn't have done it.
Right.
Like,
but he had it in him. He had it in him, he wouldn't have done it if she wasn't there.
Yeah, so that's why you get to call it sort of the everyman and the reluctant hero.
And what a character it was.
And another thing that the movie did, which other movies have tried and have had varying degrees of success, is to create what we call a charismatic villain. And this is a villain, this is somebody that we want to spend more time with him as well. And that would be Alan Rickman's Hans Gruber.
Great.
Just an incredible. And that was his very first movie. That was Alan Rickman. He had done a lot of stage plays. He'd done a lot of, you know, theater in England. But, like, completely changed the game. Look, so start looking at action movies post Die Hard. Under Siege, you got Tommy Lee Jones hamming it up. All right. Speed, you got Dennis Hopper. You know, Cliffhanger, you got John Lithgow. All of a sudden, it's important to have like these over-the-top villains that have this kind of charisma about them. And you're like, oh, I want to know more. Just change the game.
I hear you, bud. You know, and it makes I'm looking back at some of my notes. It actually is making me think about this. When you Google all these movies and you're like, oh, yeah, top 10 action movies. Yeah. Or, you know, one series, it's one of the longest series of all time motion picture movies. And you never see hardly any of them on a list. And I'm a huge fan because of my father as James Bond movies, right?
Yeah.
Talk about charismatic bad guy, right? But you don't ever see James Bond movies on a list.
If I was to say, that's great. And, right. And this was not planned. So let's just talk about for a moment.
I love curveballs for Dana.
If I was to say, and I've seen all the James Bond movies.
Yeah, I don't get it. Right? Why?
Who was the bad guy in the last James Bond movie?
That's a good question. You never know who, like the bad guy's not a big actor, but the character's big.
Like Casino Royale, you know, the Daniel Craig James Bond movie. Mads Mikkelsen was the bad guy. He says six words in the entire movie. You know, these are not bad movies,
right?
But they stray from that formula. Like, you know what James Bond movie has a really charismatic bad guy? A View to a Kill. And that was Christopher Walken.
There you go.
You know, but right. Yeah, like.
But like, you know, obviously like, Austin Powers makes fun of, you know.
Yeah, like his nemesis was Blofeld. Like that I know. Right. And you know, so he's in a couple, you know, Sean Connery, Roger Moore, James Bond movies.
Sure.
You know, but.
No, but I get it. I get it.
I think we may have just cracked the code on why the James Bond movies are, they're good, but they're not as memorable as some of these.
Because he didn't have someone against him that was probably should have had a bigger character going or a bigger actor going against him.
Like if you look at Skyfall, the 2012 James Bond movie, which is a lot of people consider to be the best Daniel Craig one. Javier Bardem plays the bad guy. That's all I remember.
Right.
Yeah.
I just remember 80s and 90s James Bond movies more.
Another reason why the last Die Hard movie doesn't work. A Good Day to Die Hard. The bad guy, the Russian bad guy.
Right. Forgettable.
No charisma.
Right.
You know, like that's another reason why that movie doesn't work.
But that's why Die Hard worked.
Exactly.
That's why it was amazing.
Yeah. Die Hard works because Bruce Willis and Alan Rickman are both amazing in it, but the movie's also really fun.
Yeah.
Let's not forget about Deputy Dwayne T. Robinson. You know, Deputy.
Played by
Paul Gleason. He's great. Sergeant Al Powell, played by Reginald Bell Johnson. He's great. Like the guy who plays Ellis, you know, the cocaine, you know, executive.
Ellis is great.
Yeah, yeah.
You're my white knight.
Yeah, he goes.
I'm your white knight.
Yeah. Yeah. Hans, Bubby.
Bubby.
He goes, hey, what am I, a method actor? Put the gun away. This is radio, not television. Ah, it's a great movie.
Is it a Christmas movie?
Of course it is.
First Blood a Christmas movie? It's during Christmas. There's Christmas lights in that town when he's blowing everything up.
Yeah, you know
it's
what?
Not a,
I don't know. All right. So what's another one on your list?
All right. So now those are my two main ones I wanted to bring up. I'm going to run through maybe two or three, and I want to see what you think.
Okay.
About maybe this list. Two I'll give you that weren't action movies, and you could pick one of these.
Okay.
I wrote down The War of the Roses and Cocktail.
Okay. Again, here are these do fall into the categories of when movies were movies. All right.
Let's
touch on The War of the Roses for a moment. Now, the selling point for The War of the Roses wasn't so much the movie itself, but it was the return of three beloved actors from two movies, Romancing the Stone and Jewel of the Nile.
Yep.
So Michael Douglas, Kathleen Turner, Danny DeVito. All right, but they're not playing the same characters.
Right.
But they're all three of them back in a movie.
And you feel connected to
them. It's a divorce movie, and it's all this, you know, it's fun. It's diabolical. It's not made for kids or teenagers.
Not exactly. That fits all this.
It's a good movie. And you know what?
It's Danny DeVito, too. Like,
yeah.
You know, I just kind of liked how it comes back to him at the end of when he's in his office.
And then Cocktail.
Cocktail has horrible reviews.
Because Cocktail, let me ask you a question, Bill.
Yeah.
Not to put you on the spot.
Okay.
What's the plot of the movie Cocktail?
A love story in a bar making drinks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's the story of...
Well, yeah, bartender's life.
So it's a story of young Brian Flanagan. All right. Who's just gotten out of the military and he's decided that he wants to strike it rich in New York City. He starts applying to all these Wall Street firms. He doesn't even have a college education. He's just out of the military. And then seemingly just wanders into a TGI Fridays on the Upper East Side and meets Brian Brown, who plays the character Douglas Coughlin, who is this older guy, experienced bartender, and teaches him that the real way to hustle people is to become a bartender. If you think about it, up until like the last 15 minutes of the movie, Tom Cruise's character is a pretty despicable guy in the movie.
Yeah.
He just gallivants around with different women. He hustles women.
What's wrong with that, Dana?
But I'm just saying, if you look back on it, like he meets Elizabeth Shue in Jamaica has this whirlwind romance
that
with her.
That sounds amazing.
And then gets dared in by Brian Brown, by Coughlin, to, you know, there's a rich woman. I bet you can't hang out with her, you know, and ends up like leaving Elizabeth Shue, who ends up being pregnant, and he tries to win her back.
All right, now I hate it. I'm out.
But I say all this, having said all of this about Cocktail, it's one of the most watchable movies of the 1980s.
Exactly.
You can't stop watching it.
Great soundtrack, too.
That speaks to the charisma of Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
He is a despicable person in this movie.
Yeah, that's true.
And you can't stop watching it. It has to make the list. I totally agree with it.
And I didn't look up all the numbers on it, but it has my favorite.
Oh, critics hated
it. Van Halen song of all time on there.
So this is the movie he makes right after Top Gun. All right. So he makes Top Gun and then rolls into Cocktail. All right. And then he goes from Cocktail to Rain Man.
Yeah. Wow.
You know.
Wow.
And then Born on the 4th of July. Like he's.
I mean, you could look at any part of his career and just go, you run the four in a row and, you know, three of them are going to be. But anyway, Cocktail hits me because of that soundtrack.
A great soundtrack.
Yeah,
Beach Boys, Kokomo. You couldn't escape that song.
I think it's a classic soundtrack.
Couldn't escape that.
So anyway,
critics hated it, though.
They did. The scoring is horrible.
They savaged it really, really
whatever.
Bad.
Whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Here's a couple more things I want to say. I wanted to bring this up. We used to go to the movie theaters, and we had talked about when movies were movies. I remember in the 90s when movie theaters were like, now what do we do when the movie's been out a while, okay, and maybe there's a big break before it actually hits rental. There used to be dollar movies.
Yeah.
So the whole movie theater, every movie was only a dollar.
Yeah.
So... there was a Plitt Theater in Countryside, and then there was a UA movie theater down in Largo that between the Plitt only had four movies, but they were all the movies that were at the regular AMC, the, you know, for 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, whatever. Then they'd go to the dollar movie. So you could go watch regular movies for only a buck.
Yep. That was, yep. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So anyway, no, the UA had like 12. We would drive like 25, 30 minutes away because they had 12 different movies you could see for a buck. And all the candy, everything was cheap.
So
I want that back.
Well, the way the dollar theaters worked, and we had those.
Did you have that in Ocala?
We didn't have that in Canada, but when I lived in Tennessee, we had
them. Oh, they did. Okay.
And in some cases, it would be movies... Dollar theaters would show movies that had just come out on home video, like the same week or something like that. And that how that works, the business side of things is because the way movie theaters work is it's a split. It's a revenue split. So when you hear about a movie today making $200 million in the theater, its opening weekend, it's really only made $100 million because theaters keep, you know, it's usually like a 50-50 split. So, but if a movie, the longer a movie stays in theater, the more the split favors the theater complex itself.
Got it.
All right. So, you know, for example, a movie like Avatar, The Way of Water, when it first comes out, Disney owns the rights to that movie. They're going to tell movie theaters, hey, we're going to let you show this movie, but for the first 3 weeks, it's a 60-40 split in our favor. But the longer you keep that movie in the theater, the better that percentage works out for you. So if you've got in your theater 10 weeks, by the time you get into that 9th, 10th week, it's probably an 80-20 split in favor of the movie theater. So the way these dollar theaters work is if it's not a pre-negotiated per screening showing, it could be as simple. It could be like a 90-10 split in favor of the movie theater. So
right.
If they're only charging a dollar, 90 cents of that, you know, 10 cents of that's going to the movie studio. And they don't care at this point. They're getting ready for the home video release. But these movie theaters make their money on concessions. That's how they make their
money.
And
I remember them having deals, man. I mean, I just can't imagine going to the movies and just only paying a dollar. And then this is the same time we have pay phones.
Yeah.
Freaking pay phone. I was watching 48 Hours. And I'm like, oh my God, he's using a payphone.
Yep.
I remember when payphones were only 10 cents and it had switched to 25 cents for just one call.
People were outraged.
I know.
Up in arms about that.
I know, what a markup that was. But anyway, one more thing. I'm going to run a list by you. All right. You get to pick one of these and just say one thing.
Okay.
You ready?
Yep.
All right. Seven, Fargo, Face Off, Good Will Hunting, A Few Good Men. I wrote The Untouchables down here.
Okay.
I put RoboCop. All right. How about that?
Well, they're all, every one of those falls into the category of when movies were movies.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So I guess I made a good list.
But if I have to pick one of them.
Yeah, you only can pick one.
I'll take Paul Verhoeven's 1987 directed RoboCop.
Yeah, but you love that one. I shouldn't have said that. That's only too easy. That's a layup for you.
It's a layup. It is a layup. Absolutely. That's actually somebody's put a ladder next to the net, and I'm just going to climb up the ladder and just put the ball right in.
Love RoboCop.
RoboCop is one of the great movies of all time, not just one of the great action movies of the 1980s. It's one of the smartest science fiction action films ever made. And the thing about RoboCop is it is... Gosh, there's going to be listeners out there going, again, we're going to hear you talk about this movie.
I know,
again.
I'm sorry.
No, but the thing is, it's such a, it took a brilliant Dutch director in Paul Verhoeven to basically take a look at sort of the 1980s landscape of film and say, Americans seem to be obsessed with this, this, and this. I'm going to give it to them on a different level.
Right.
So it's a satire about consumerism. It's a satire about consumerism. Like you said, the marketing messages. Corporate takeovers. And above all, it's a satire on America's obsession with violence.
Yeah.
That movie is so violent.
Violent technology mixing with
And it's brilliant, and it's so sad that none of the sequels were able to capture sort of what that original movie was about.
What year was that?
1987.
See, it's amazing. So there's a sweet spot for me.
Yeah.
And I'm 12 or 13 or whatever it is. So like 86, 87, 88, there is a sweet spot where I was allowed to see action movies.
Yeah.
You know, I was allowed to go to the movies by myself, but I also was old enough to go with my dad. This whole time right there, that's right in the middle of my sweet spot, where I remember going with my dad, two buddies, and their dad.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, we're running out of time on this episode, so I've got a couple other movies that I'm going to save for volume 3 of When Movies Were Movies.
Is that okay? Yeah. Sorry.
We absolutely. No. Listen. This is great. So I think what we're going to do moving forward, because you're always evolving when you start a new series inside of a podcast, is... Instead of telling listeners I've got 5 on my list, we're just going to talk about movies until we run out of time, and then we'll go on to that. So
here we are. That's what we did.
Perfect. This is going to come in just at right about an hour, exactly the sweet spot that I was looking for. So, Bill, thank you so much, my friend.
Thanks for having me, Dana. And it's thanks for the feedback out there.
Yeah, keep the emails coming. We want to know what movies would make your list of when movies were movies.
Appreciate you.
Absolutely. My name is Dana Buckler, and thank you so much for listening.